Hello, you're listening to Spoiler
Filled
Film Conversation.
Hooray! Woo!
Yay.
So, once again, it's time to make a podcast where we talk about films, or a film in this case, and every case. It is Invasion of the Body Snatchers, right? And it is from 1978. So, Jamie, seeing as you picked it, can you give the full details? Wow. The abridged details of the film.
Invasion of the Body Snatchers from 1978 is directed by Philip Kaufman, written by Jack Finney, well, based on Jack Finney's novel, screenplay by W.D. Richter. It stars Donald Sutherland, Brooke Adams, Jeff Goldblum, Veronica Cartwright, and Leonard Nimoy. And the summary, in San Francisco, a group of people discover the human race is being replaced one by one with clones devoid of emotion. And it's a remake of what is considered like a sci-fi classic from 1956, which is the same story, the same title, except it was set in a small town instead of a big city.
So, you know, why remake it is the question I'd ask.
I don't know. With remakes, people seem to think it's a recent phenomenon, but it's been going on forever.
As soon as something gets dust on it, it's worthy of redoing entirely again.
It does seem to be done more often and quicker now.
Yeah.
As with, every 2 weeks they remake Spider-Man, but
I think in the case with this one particularly, it's got such a strong kind of core idea that it's is really kind of frightening. Like
yeah,
if you put yourself into it, there's many different ways.
Depending on when it was made and then remade, it can serve as an allegory for different things. Like the original from 56 can very much be seen to be about McCarthyism.
Right.
I'm not so sure about 78, maybe. I mean,
is there a president in the 70s who has a E at the
well,
end?
You had Vietnam, everyone was disenfranchised, and it was the same thing of nobody trusting the government, and then you've got these ideas of control and people devoid of emotion taking over and all this. It's all kind of, I don't want to call it like cliches, because I don't think, certainly at the time, it was particularly cliche, but it's definitely things that come up very often, particularly in sci-fi.
Yeah. And maybe now if they made it, they'd make it about social media or something contemporary.
Yeah, well, there's plenty of stuff
some issue.
Apply it to, yeah. And I picked it just because I'd never seen it, but I'd always heard of it. It's one of those films that's always mentioned. This one and the original, usually in the same breath when people talk about like sci-fi classics.
Yeah, so you haven't seen the original. Wait, so you haven't seen the first one?
No, I've only seen this one, and this right. I hadn't seen it before this.
Speaking of having not seen things, I have not seen this or the first one. I have very much missed it this time round, but I'll soldier on. You guys can talk about it. It's fine. Anthony, did you see any of them?
I've only seen this Body Snatchers, only because I watched it for this. But before that, I hadn't seen any of them. Same with Jamie. It's like I've always heard of this film being highly regarded as kind of like a psychological horror sci-fi. So I was really kind of excited to see it this time around, see what all the fuss was about, really.
And it's been remade several times. There's the 56 one, there's this 78 one, there's one in 93, and then there was one in 2007.
And yet I still couldn't be bothered. No, I had reasons. There were reasons. There were good ones and some poor ones. I will guide you guys through a healthy debate about it, nevertheless. What really is it about?
It isn't the most, like, one of its strengths actually is that it isn't particularly complex. Like, what the summary I read out on IMDb is pretty much it. You have a strained relationship with a husband and wife, where he already seems somewhat distant, but there's a normal relationship there. And then she finds this little flower growing out of a pod on a plant outside, and she brings it home. And then one day she wakes up to find him sweeping up. There's a nice shot of the plant glowing next to the bed, and then she wakes up and he's sweeping up and acting very strangely. And it
yeah,
starts...
men's untidy.
No, exactly. He took out the bins and everything. But one of the things that becomes a recurring image in the film, and I don't know if people pick up on it immediately, I don't know how sort of heavy-handed it is there's lots of things being big mounds of dust being thrown away, and it's no one ever says anything about it, but there's this recurring image of a big rubbish truck with stuff being thrown in it, and it keeps appearing throughout the film. It appears more often as the film goes on, and without telling you, what's happening is that when these alien plant things copy a person, they do it while they're asleep, and then the person just turns to dust, they crumble away, and the clone sweeps them up in the bin and chucks them away.
Weird.
And that's what's happening. And there's a really good shot later on in the film of, which is where I first noticed it, of Leonard Nimoy's character, where he leans on a skip, and it's just full of these big, like, you know when you empty a Hoover and you pull all the stuff out, and it's this big, like, clump of gross, like, hair and dust and...
And a Lego man and...
yeah.
Nail trimmings. Go on, yeah.
He's, like, leaning next to this mound of that in a skip. And that was the first time I thought, oh, I've been seeing that all the way through this film and haven't even noticed. And that's what's left of the people who've been copied.
So flowers are cloning people, replacing them, and turning them to dust.
Yeah, the film makes no... deliberately doesn't try and sort of make it a mystery of what's actually happening to the audience. Because it begins with, you see a shot of these strange sort of... They're like these little fibres on a planet, and they drift off into space, and then they're carried on like solar winds, and they rain down on Earth, and that's how the film starts. So it's telling the audience outright, it's like, this is what's happening. Now you get to see all these people figure it out. There's no mystery in it for the audience, but that doesn't really seem like the point.
Yeah. Who are the protagonists of this film?
We've got Brooke Adams, who plays Elizabeth, and Donald Sutherland, who plays Matthew, and he works for the Department of Health. So he goes around to restaurants and shuts them down because there's rat droppings in their soup and that kind of thing.
Right.
So he already works for the government. So when things start to spiral out of control and he can't get any help, it creates this idea that the government's already been taken over. And they have... I was never positive whether or not... Because she's married and her husband gets taken over... But she seems to be having an affair with his character, Matthew. But it's never spelled out particularly.
Yeah, they do have a very close relationship.
Yeah.
But they don't make it clear, I think.
Close enough that he knows her weird eye trick.
Yeah. What's her weird eye trick?
Which, I don't know how to describe it. It must be something that the actress could do and the director saw her do it and went, oh. We have to stick that in there because it's more frightening than any of the alien special effects in the film. She can, I don't even know how to describe it. She can dart her eyes back and forth at incredible speed.
Kind of like they're vibrating.
Yeah. And I'm still not positive that it wasn't a special effect.
So he must be being intimate with her because she's done that for him?
Yeah. It shows that they're very close and that they know each other very well. They may or may not be having an affair. At the end of the film, they fall in love, but you don't know whether they're already involved at the start. And it's never sort of nothing is apart from nothing between the characters is particularly spelled out in this film. Like it feels very natural. You just go along with them on the ride, and you watch them figure stuff out. And it's all very it was surprisingly naturalistic.
Yeah, it's very much
it's not like. So it's all just real people dealing with something weird the writers have come up with.
There was very little. in the way of like actual special effects. There's only sort of two or three scenes where anything significant of that sort happens.
Sounds a bit like, I don't know, The Twilight Zone or maybe Black Mirror, which was a contemporary TV show about weird stuff happening and playing out realistically in Britain.
It is. It's not as stylized as that stuff. It's very naturalistic, and you get a lot of like characters talking over each other, and you can't quite catch what somebody's saying because everybody's talking at the same time. Like, and
like a bad moment in this podcast.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But you're right, though. I think it's one of its strengths is how naturalistic it is, because it's kind of just portraying, well, this is how it would go down, and that is kind of like really the most horrific thing, because it's as it plays out, it's kind of showing you as an audience that there is no kind of way out of this.
Yeah.
Do the bees all disappear? And everyone's like, where are all the bees?
Off screen.
There is actually an element of nature in the sound, because in the soundtrack, the film starts, you can hear normal sounds, people talking in the distance, birds and all that kind of stuff. And music as well. I remember there's like very little music apart from in certain scenes. But as the film goes on, the natural background sounds disappear and it all becomes just the sounds of machinery, like the rubbish truck and that kind of stuff.
So why is it just the nature of whatever this alien plant is to just take over? Like, what is it? What's the motivation of this threat?
Well, I don't think they delve in too deep with that, but essentially it's just where they caught a lift.
Yeah.
On a gust of wind. Well, and
it turns out later on that Leonard Nimoy's character, who's a psychiatrist who Matthew takes Elizabeth to for help, because he thinks she's just losing her mind, because she's talking about how her husband isn't her husband, there's something wrong with him, he's someone else. Mm-hmm. And she takes him to Leonard Nimoy's character, Dr. Kibner, and he says, oh, I've been seeing a lot of this lately, but it's this strange mass hysteria, but people get over it in a couple of days, and you find out he's already been taken over. And he explains to the characters before he tries to change them towards the end, this is just what they do. This is what his species does. They drift from planet to planet, and they just take it over, they colonize it, and then they move on to the next world.
So is it just in their nature? It's just that part of... It's just like, you know, we just are all part of an evolutionary process or something. It's doing it because it's the nature of...
Yeah, it's just... In that sense, they're kind of like us, just a different thing. They move on to places, they colonize them, and then they keep going.
We turn up, they take their culture, ruin everything they had that was nice, and make out like it's no big deal.
But, because of how naturalistic it is, when something strange or horrific happens, there are times when it's really disturbing.
Right. On what scale do we get everyone being replaced? Is it quite a rapid thing where all these things delete, basically, people and replace them? Is there thousands of people all changing at the same time? Or
presumably. By the end of the film, it's everyone. We have Veronica Cartwright's character, Nancy. And towards the end of the film, when they're all making a getaway, they lose her. And the end of the film is a really famous scene. Matthew Donald Sutherland's character gets away because she figures out if you hide your emotions, they can't pick up that you're different.
But you still have to live in their weird world.
Yeah, where everyone's kind of flat and autistic. But he burns down a factory where they're like manufacturing these pods, and then it skips ahead and he's in work, and you assume he's acting emotionless to try and blend in. And then Nancy turns up at the end and she finds him and she's elated. She's, you know, she can't hide it. She's happy. And he points at her and does this horrible scream that these aliens do when they recognize someone who isn't one of them. And then that's the end of the film.
I cautiously want to hear one of you guys do an impression. It's too loud.
You don't. You don't want to hear it.
Is it like this?
Hey! And then everybody runs in.
if we were colonizing other worlds, just be like, hey, that one's not one of us.
if it was British people, it would be way, and everyone would chase after them.
right. I mean, it sounds kind of morbidly interesting. It sounds kind of one of those things that would creep you out. I think anyone just being unemotional is kind of weird. I don't know.
It is. I mean, the ending is bleak. You know, the presumption is everyone's now been taken over, and that's it.
Then the Twilight theme hits, and we all go, oh, that's a good episode. Actually,
it's interesting that there's no music over the credits. It's just silence.
There's very little, like you're saying, there is very little music during the whole thing. And in fact, I think, I'd say the first three quarters, all of the music that we do hear is all diegetic.
Yeah.
But then towards the end, they do bring out the orchestra when it's just kind of like two people running in the dark.
And I did think that was kind of a shame. Like, I like the idea of there just being no score.
Yeah, because it's really effective. It's really kind of, the whole soundscape is just really kind of experimental and kind of edgy. Yeah. It really keeps you on the edge of your seat.
I think
keeps the dread factor there, does it?
Yeah, it makes it creepy, and I think there's a scene towards the end that would have worked better had there been no score at all, which is when they hear the music coming from the ship.
Yes.
They hear the Amazing Grace played on bagpipes, and if you'd gone for this whole segment of them being chased with no music, that would have sounded just as good to you as it did to them.
Mm-hmm. I agree. But all the way through, it's even in the scenes where it's not particularly tense or atmospheric, like the weird soundscape is always there to like kind of confuse you and keep you on edge.
I will say there was one musical choice that could either be really frightening or hilarious depending on the type of person you are, and it's when they're making their getaway at the end of the film and they're among crowds of these people and they're trying to hide their emotions. There's a character who's set up early on in the film who's a hobo who plays the banjo.
God, yes.
And he has a pet dog. And then later on in the film, they find his body and the dog's body, and they're unconscious in the street, and there's a pod next to them, and the pod's bleeding. Presumably something's gone wrong. Like, somebody kicked it over or something has gone wrong. And then they leave it and they carry on. And then when they're trying to hide in the crowd and hide their emotions, the banjo music kicks in and this little dog runs in and it's got a human face.
What?
And if you're invested in the film at this point, it can be quite disturbing. Mm-hmm. But because of the banjo music, I couldn't help it.
Yeah, same. You can't.
Because it's
such an out of the place moment as well.
I can think of where, and it is something, you know, in 1978, you wouldn't have really seen that before. So I can imagine audiences going,
I still haven't seen it. Still haven't seen it.
It's a kind of precursor to the kind of stuff you're kind of seeing in John Carpenter's The Thing.
Yeah, that's what it reminded me of. Just sillier.
Yeah.
I'm imagining sort of Pierce Brosnan in Mars Attacks when he's attached to a dog.
But it's the only time that something like this has happened. So the shock factor is really kind of like, whoa.
Is it like a mistake? Or like, why did they do that? It's just part
The idea is that this pod tried to copy both of them and it got messed up. So it's kind of mapped them together.
I like that. Like, what are the other possibilities? Just a woman and a cat and just like... like if you're eating a steak, it thinks the steak's part of you. Like, how does that work? Just organic things get copied. That guy was holding a pineapple. Now he's got a pineapple hand.
But it's something, because they needed something to get Elizabeth to scream, to show that she still has emotions. Because then the crowd like turns and they all scream at her because she's different and they chase after them.
Wait, so like they're all like, we suspect, but I know. Get the dog-faced man in.
No, the dog's just running around. It just runs out of the crowd. And she sees it and she goes, and...
And to be fair, it is probably the perfect excuse for her to actually make a noise and be emotional, because it is horrible.
It was funny in the context of the film, but if I saw that in real life, banjo music as well, I would run away.
Yeah. I mean, you know, banjo music is pretty terrifying. itself.
But I think that does depend very much on the viewer. I can imagine somebody being disturbed, and I can imagine somebody laughing out loud.
I think I would have gone for a laugh as well.
But there are, there are other just intended disturbing scenes that work. There's one where Matthew falls asleep in his back garden, and
creepy. There's more.
Donald Sutherland's pretty creepy looking in the 70s with his moustache and everything.
Isn't he though?
The aliens attach themselves to people initially with these sort of hair-like fibres.
Yeah.
And then what they do is they use whatever's in that person to make copies. And he's in the garden and all his friends who are sticking together through all this are asleep in the house. And while people are asleep, that's when they copy them. And all the pods that Dr. Kibner, the psychiatrist who's pretending to help them, has hidden in his garden, start to hatch. And there's this really long sequence of these half-human, slimy things emerging from these pods and sort of writhing around in the grass as they form the characters that we've. And it lasts forever. And it's really upsetting.
John Carpenter, it sounds very...
I could see where he would have watched this and presumably the original and got a lot of his ideas for the more sort of grotesque effects in The Thing.
Hmm. So when was The Thing made, actually? Wasn't that the 70s as well?
81.
Ah, okay.
I think.
But I wonder what would have gone within it's a shame we didn't watch all of the versions so we could compare and contrast across because, you kind of wonder what they would have done with the technology in the 50s.
The Thing was 82.
Okay, so that's fair. Not saying he ripped it off, we're just saying
he probably would have enjoyed it. No, I think it's probably an influence. There's probably, if I've watched this, if I watch The Thing again, there's probably some direct, deliberate references in there somewhere.
Yeah, actually, Invasion of the Body Snatchers is often referenced by things, and I mean, The Simpsons have pretty much referenced everything in the world, but it does come up quite often, that idea of when people are uncanny clones but are actually devoid of emotion. That's a very, it's a very fun thing to play around with because it's just something fascinating about paranoia and thinking that someone is the same but different today.
There's a really good scene in this that plays on that paranoia aspect when Matthew is trying to get help from other government agencies, and it shows him sort of wandering around the city amongst all these emotionless people as the soundtrack is just all these different government officials just blowing him off with excuses and, don't worry about it. It's the thing going on. Are you sure you're not just being paranoid? And they're all talking at the same time while he's wandering around looking freaked out.
Yeah.
And it's really just disorientating and confusing to listen to, but it works because he's just become overwhelmed by this idea that it's now everywhere and there's nothing he can do.
Yes, well, I guess it plays on, ideas that would be terrifying to people. I mean, they're weird and outlandish, but it is something that is... If the world around you changes and you're the crazy one and you know you're not, it's kind of impossibly terrifying.
Yeah.
Especially with, the efficiency they get in this film towards the end. There's a scene where they find they've been discovered because they're on the phone and someone uses their real name or something. And, they just look out the window and all of a sudden, everyone in the vicinity is just rushing towards the house that they're in.
There were a couple of scenes that reminded me of some of the more recent zombie... Well, recent. I was thinking of the remake of Dawn of the Dead, and that was 10 years ago. But that and 28 Days Later and the imagery of people, a horde of people who have been changed in some way, infected or taken over, rushing towards you, particularly down an alley or down a street. A lot of that imagery was very similar.
Yeah.
So is the idea early on, when there's not enough of them copied yet, they have to talk down the fact that there's something weird going on, because if the humans realise, they might be able to stop them, and then after a while there's enough of them to just...
It starts out very subtle, and then by the end of the film, they're just rounding people up.
They get cocky and I think we got this now. I think we can out ourselves as weird, emotion-free. Well, so why are they emotion-free? That's just because they're alien to us. There's no...
It's just in their nature. That's what they are. That's what they're like.
Maybe they can learn to emote. We could teach them how to laugh at cat videos and... I don't know. Like, couldn't we teach them to be bitter and angry, or all the fun emotions? Could live in harmony. They can. You know, most of the week, most of us are pretty neutral and sort of numbed to life. Anyway, it's only the occasional times we chirp up with happiness or something.
It's like stiff upper lip British people invading a more lively country and just telling them, no, let's not make a fuss.
One of us now. Yeah, okay. Were there any other bits for you, Anthony, that kind of stood out as kind of really interesting moments?
There are a few. I think I'd probably talk about the performances rather. We haven't really got into it yet.
Yeah, whatever suits you.
It's just, I'm just really impressed with the people they chose, because, like, all the actors, like Donald Sutherland, Jeff Goldblum's in there, Brooke Adams, all have this kind of natural way of acting, or at least they can make it look like what they're saying is improvised very well.
So yeah.
I think that, and that really kind of adds to the whole kind of naturalistic feel of the whole film. Like, they actually feel like real people.
It could have been a much more of a melodrama, couldn't it? And it was good to avoid it in this case, you're saying.
Yeah, especially as I was expecting something a bit more B-movie-ish, if you know.
They're all here, but they're not really them. No!
I like the fact that with the performances, maybe this is just me, but there's not necessarily a character that the film is trying to get you to like. They're just people.
Yeah.
They're not necessarily the hero or
and there's not even particularly a main character. I suppose you could argue that Donald Sutherland is the main character, but he doesn't start off as the main character. It makes it look like the woman is Elizabeth.
I was surprised that Elizabeth didn't survive. Like
I know what you mean. It kind of from conventions of kind of film watching, it's like she's the kind of leading lady in a horror film. She's the one who needs to have survived by the end.
Yeah. You know what I mean? Because I knew what happens to Donald Sutherland at the end, I assumed that she somehow survived.
Well, I suppose on the one hand, we are sympathising with anyone who's human because, you know, we're emotionally attached to other humans. And don't like scary neutral aliens, even if they might be quite reasonable once they're all once they've taken over. Maybe Earth will become a utopia. Because...
Well, they do. They catch them towards the end of the film, and Leonard Nimoy's character tries to. They're going to get changed, but he tries to talk them into it. He's like, you know, it doesn't hurt. Soon you'll be free of love and hate. And all that kind of stuff. Like
I'll be dust in a dumpster.
The thing that I thought was interesting was that they're not. When someone's copied, they retain all their memories. Like they're still themselves. They're just in this new, like, symbiotic relationship with this emotionless alien.
Weird. But I guess it is odd to have an ending where basically we're taken over and all the humans fail, and I guess you. And unless you, in the cinema, you turn and there's either piles of dust or all of your friends are suddenly being emotionless going, yes, that was adequate. Let us go and eat grey food or whatever. it's not going to be very scary because, well, that didn't happen and wouldn't happen. And if it did happen, I would be scared, but whatevs. Like, you know, like some horror films, you should come out and go, I'm actually scared to go down dark alleys now. Maybe you'd be frightened of, like, little flowers or something.
It depends on the kind of horror film and what you went expecting. Like if it's something like Silence of the Lambs, where, you know, there are people who have done similar things to what Buffalo Bill does.
Yeah.
It makes it creepy in the sense that it's not outside the realm of possibility, whereas this is more about creating a feeling rather than recreating a realistic experience.
Yeah, I guess. But then maybe the convention you were expecting was that the heroine sort of wins in the end, or at least has some kind of victory or doesn't die. I mean, but then even if she didn't die, she was the only human left, and her emotions, she kept them under wraps. I mean, would she just live a boring secret life of emotions at the house?
It's what happens to Veronica Cartwright's character who survives right up until the end. And then she's just as screwed as everyone else because there is no one left. None of her original group are left.
Plus, presumably, culture, even if you get to secretly indulge in culture and occasionally emote and feel things, you know, the world isn't going to create any more things for you, presumably. It'll be efficient and cold and heartless. So there's no point living in that world, in a way, unless you can defeat them all.
And that's what, like, the final kind of section of the film really sums up just really well. Because you have Donald Sutherland just kind of going about his everyday life, just, like, emotionless. And the way they're playing it makes it seem like he's still a human. So as an audience member, you're just kind of thinking of all these things of, is there really much difference if he's just going to be there pretending to be these people anyway?
Yeah, what's the point? It's a really nihilistic, hopeless ending. Because even if they survived, what would they do?
Yeah, it's a compelling idea. But I'm not sure what, other than defeating them all and like keep blasting them off into the sun, and somehow, unless they solve the problem, surviving isn't really what people want to do. You know?
I think that's part of the point really of the film, and part of what's intended to be disturbing about it is, you keep realizing with Donald Sutherland, with Matthew and Elizabeth, as they realize, there's less and less hope and reason to keep going. Because every time they think they find a way out or a solution, something else happens to show them. Like when they find the ship at the end, and he says, there's a ship we can sail off out to sea, because I guess he's assuming that so far it's only San Francisco. And then he sees them loading the pods onto the ship, and he just like, oh, they're everywhere.
I guess this sounds very bleak.
It is bleak. It's very much part of that like 70s... new wave depressing cinema.
Oh, anyway.
There's a priest on a swing.
Oh, who doesn't love a priest on a swing? Why was there a priest on a swing?
No reason.
Robert Duvall's cameo. He is the first real sign you get that something's not right.
Because priests don't go on swings.
It's right at the start when Elizabeth is walking around and she's in a park and she sees all these kids on a swing, and all the kids are doing what kids do on swings. Their legs are swinging, they're laughing, and they're
jacking up heroin.
A priest played by Robert Duvall, and he's sitting on the swing and he's doing, like, physically doing the same thing as them. He's swinging his legs up and then back so that he goes up and down, and he just has this totally blank expression on his face. And what I assumed is happening is that that's these aliens having just arrived. They've copied one of their first people and they're observing the other people nearby and copying their behavior because they assume, well, this is a normal thing to do, I guess.
So it's kind of weird because they try and they're learning, the aliens are learning to copy and getting it more accurate, presumably, as it goes on.
Yeah.
But they also... Why can't they just copy emotions? Like, I know it might be a bit hard to grasp, but they'd be much more convincing if they could do, I don't know, some fake laughter. That is amazing.
You do get ones that are presumably taken over who do, like Leonard Nimoy's character, Dr. Kibner. He seems perfectly human the whole time.
Yeah.
And then you find out he's so... I don't know if there are some that are adept at faking emotions, and they develop this. Like, there are certain ones that have developed this ability as they've taken over more people so that they can blend in and make it a little bit more convincing.
But then, once they've taken over, do they go, oh, finally, we can relax and not feign emotion? Or do they become human and essentially replace exactly humans? And essentially, some of the time, we do kind of fake our emotions anyway in order to have an easier life, I guess, or to make friends or something. No, that's not what I'm saying now. I'm just saying, like, people feign their emotions occasionally because no one's in the right frame of mind all the time. Yeah. So is there a world where they exactly replicate humans? Or does it go to a point of, finally, we can close culture up and everyone can stop pretending to be interested in music? And...
There is just like a bit of symbolism at the end. Like where there's just kind of scientists, because he works in like a health and safety thing, lab. So there's lots of scientists, and they're just kind of sitting around, staring off into space. And there's
they're not talking.
Yeah, and there's like one moment where one of them just like switches off this machine, which is like whirling some yellow liquid. And it's just all a kind of symbolism of just everything stopping now.
Yeah, it's like now they've taken over, they don't have to pretend anymore, so everything becomes flat. Which is why when Veronica Cartwright turns up and is so happy that she's found Donald Sutherland, that's what singles her out.
So the aliens' plan, I guess that's where they go to new places, because, we've done that, that's that achieved. Oh, I'm bored now, nothing to do because we don't do anything because we're emotionless. Let's do it all again, it's the only thing we live for, is to take over things. You'd think, the thing I'd expect is, right, we've all won as the race, we've all took over, let's do a massive giant art attack. That could be seen from space, just a big, like a monkey sitting under a palm tree, but it's made out of like masses of material and you could see it from the moon or whatever.
Oh, and then somebody talks to that freaky head thing in the...
yeah, Art Attack reference there. Good job.
For our international listeners.
For our old international listeners. Yeah.
Specifically people who remember Neil Buchanan's era of Art Attack when there was a stupid talking head thing. Oh, dear. Every joke would always be buying something has popped up and fallen off.
My assumption was that once they have taken over, they don't feel they have to pretend anymore and they just become flat and then they move on to the next place.
Right.
And that even though they've totally like assimilated us and there's technically no difference, there is, it's because like, I suppose it's kind of trying to say like emotion and love is kind of the driving force moving us forward.
Yeah.
Whereas when that's gone, we just kind of stop.
So is it a message to people who are kind of cold and just harsh or just, I don't know, who is it preaching to? Borderline autistic people or just people who are just like not, just killjoys and people who don't like art and culture and I don't know, like who is it worrying about? Who's it moralizing to?
Hard to say. I suppose maybe like, the 70s would really have been the start of kind of overpopulation with the world, and
also as
there are more and more people, we're bound to become like more and more kind of homogenized. Maybe not the right word there.
Well, you've got people moving away from the 60s and the summer of love and all that stuff, and as that kind of bled away, it's people shrugging and going, what's left? And I suppose the film is saying, well, you're still, you know, a human being. You can't just think, well, that's done now. Let's leave all that behind and just become completely soulless.
Hmm. I guess it's an interesting what-if sort of movie then. It's just sort of saying, wouldn't this be scary? And it kind of plays on the ideas of paranoia as a form of horror. It does sound interesting, if a little, you know, odd and silly.
With the paranoia element, there was one flaw in it that stood out quite strongly to me that I still don't understand. And near the end of the film, when Elizabeth and Matthew are running away a lot, they, at this point, they have assumed that, like, they can't really escape. Like, they don't really know where to go. They've started to think that maybe this is also going on everywhere else. So they decide to go to the airport and they get in a cab.
Yeah.
What did they think was going to happen when they got in a cab? Like, wouldn't you just assume that all the cab drivers were now taken over if you're assuming everyone else has been too? Why wouldn't...
No, cab drivers are tremendously resilient to aliens taking them over. So they just be like, hi, where you going?
That was one of the things.
Let me tell you what's wrong with the world again. Oh, what's with all these drones going around being absolute blank canvases? God, probably the blooming media. Or immigrants coming over here or something.
I didn't understand why they did that. Why did they get in a taxi and say, yes, take us to the airport so we can escape? What?
Did they then the cab driver turn around and they go, oh, black
pretty
hair.
Pretty much, yeah. He drives up to a police blockade and then just goes to the police officer who comes with the car, both of them, and they just get out and run away. why did you bother?
Yeah, get a tandem bike. That's what they needed.
Well, it goes from there to them running to the factory where they find the pods being made. So that taxi scene just seems completely redundant.
Anthony, did you have any moments that you think maybe lay it down? If you seem to have both enjoyed it. Were there moments that were like, that wasn't so clever?
I'd say maybe towards the end, the scene Jamie just mentioned when they're in the factory. I suppose like they're trying to build it up as a kind of, this is the moment where Donald Sutherland kind of saves the day and blows everything up and stuff like that. But really all he does is kind of like knock a few lights off and that somehow makes the building explode.
Oh, you know, they don't make him like they used to.
But honestly, I can't really think of much bad with this film. Like most kind of horrors from this kind of 70s, it's got a slower pace, which isn't for everyone, I guess. But that really just helps to build the whole kind of atmosphere of the film.
I would sort of warn somebody going in, depending on who they are, that like it's dated, because I think it is. It's a prime example of a kind of it's obviously from the 70s.
Yes.
Right. But you know, it is a style of movie that that's probably just a nice change of pace from the usual modern horrors.
Yeah.
I don't know if there's much left to say other than it was just a really good psychological horror film that just keeps kind of building and building.
I would say you have lots to interpret
and think about and go, put yourself in those shoes. How would you react?
I would say, in the back of your mind, if you are someone susceptible to paranoia who believes that lizard people have taken over secretly, maybe don't watch it.
Well, they have. What are you talking about? That, I mean, that's, everyone pretty much agrees that, right? The sports guy went nuts, explained it all. It kind of made sense. What's his name?
David Icke.
David Icke. Yeah, David Icke was like, well, if you hear him speak, it sounds perfectly logical. I don't know what's wrong with you, Jamie. I mean, obviously, David Cameron, the Queen, the bushes. That's not the plant. We don't want to get confused. But yeah, you know, lizard people do rule the world. But they shouldn't watch this because it'll just add fuel to the fire, you're saying.
Yeah. There is a great scene as well where the actor from the original Invasion of the Body Snatchers, whose name I can't remember, but there's his own iconic scene equivalent of Donald Sutherland's scream is the end of the original, or towards the end of the original, where he's shouting to everyone about how they're here, they're taking over, and then he points to the audience and says, and they'll be coming after you, you're next. And then in this, when Matthew and Elizabeth are driving around, he runs up to the car, like he's being chased, and says basically the same thing to them. And nice. You have to let me in, you're next. And then he runs off and a crowd of people chase after him. And he goes around the corner and gets hit by a car and killed. But no, it's just a nice little...
That's a good nod to the original.
Yeah.
Yeah, I like that. That's a nice thing to do.
Kevin McCarthy, I think, was that actor's name.
Hmm. What do we rate this on? What blank canvas is... What blank things are devoid of emotion, would you say? This is exactly 3.5 stars, some funny bits. I don't know, what's the rating system going to be, guys? You watched it? What flower? What priest on a swing?
What weird Jeff Goldblum noise is it?
Yeah. Got to prove you're human, guys. You've got to create some emotion here.
I don't know, because there's no real kind of big iconic factors about this film to latch onto.
Even as good as it was, the only bit everyone seems to really know is Donald Sutherland screaming at the end.
I guess the reason why it gets replicated so much is because it's good. So it's
Yeah, it's versatile enough idea for a story that you can wait every decade or every couple of decades and make it again, and it can be about something completely new, just following the same basic premise.
Someone should make it again, but have it all devoid of emotion all the way through. Make no one feel anything. So it's the film itself gets cloned, and that would be kind of artistically valid, I think. Atrocious movie to have a really neutral movie. But I think it would be kind of witty, clever film snob in me once. They should make that. That would be hilarious.
But in a way that doesn't actually make you laugh. It just makes you appreciate that it's funny.
No, you feel nothing about it. You don't even hate it. You're just like, that was a thing.
it was a
replica.
Maybe it's something like, do you know when they have CGI in like films and they try and make a human character, but like the closer and closer it gets to actually being human, the like, creepier and creepier it actually looks. So it's kind of like that kind of effect going on with the film.
Yeah, funny you should say that, because wasn't Donald Sutherland in that Final Fantasy, that awful Final Fantasy film from the 90s?
We don't talk about that.
So in a way, it is a creepy, close-to-human film. It's close to genius, but it's just something off about it. But then that is a success in itself. Because it wouldn't be creepy if it just, you know, it wouldn't be that much of a problem if things do, like, we have, like, bacteria and stuff on us now, living off of us, so it's, bacteria, as far as we know, lets us get on with things how we want to. Or does it? Does bacteria hold back some sixth sense or something that we all don't use because bacteria says, no, you don't need that? Oh, I'm worried now, bacteria's gonna, it's taking us all over, living off of us. Scary. Yeah, I'm just scared now. I've given myself weird thoughts. I guess that'll do as a rating, right, guys? I mean, it is hard to think of the right gimmicky idea to sum it up.
Yeah, it's hard because it's done in such a naturalistic and workmanlike way. It's really hard to be abstract and silly about it.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
So it is a rather eerie clone of some description, but it is just a compelling sci-fi that you guys recommend.
Oh, definitely, yeah.
Especially if you are a fan of science fiction anyway. Like, if you haven't seen it, you kind of have to. And I'll probably go back and watch the original 56 version now as well, just out of curiosity.
Do you think you'll watch the Always one as well?
No.
Just no, no. Modern things are rubbish.
It has a reputation. The Invasion.
It's the poor clone. It's the piece on the swing of. We assume we haven't even seen it. We're just here. Okay. Well, we could just bid our listeners goodbye, unless they've been replaced by emotion-free people who don't really. They're just consuming it to keep the illusion going. I mean, if that is you, give us a break. We need emotions. Come on. I mean, there is war and stuff, but there's also music. So, good and bad, isn't it, with humans? I kind of forget what I'm saying. We should just say goodbye, though, right, guys?
Yes. Goodbye, everyone.
Bye.
Bye.